Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio is Brooke Masters, Chief Regulation Correspondent, Charlene Goff, Retail Banking Correspondent, and Alistair Gray, our Insurance Correspondent. This week, we'll discuss Barclays' decision to appoint Anthony Jenkins, an internal candidate, as their new Chief Executive.
It's very much that idea of safe, reliable, rather than inspirational, rather than something that got investors really excited last week.
We'll take a look at RBS floating its insurance arm, Direct Line.
There's clearly a pretty tough market out there for IPOs at the moment. This would be the biggest flotation by a UK company in the past 3 years. So it is debatable whether you'd do this now unless you had to.
And finally, we'll look into the possibility that banking liquidity rules could be softened.
The liquidity rules are the first ever attempt to deal with the run that brought down Lehman Brothers. And the global regulators really want to have rules in place to prevent that from happening again, but they don't actually know how they'll work in practice.
First, though, to the Barclays story. And Charlene, Anthony Jenkins has been appointed as the bank's new CEO. This kind of ends 2 months of pretty turbulent news for the bank. The CEO, Bob Diamond, and Marcus Hages, the chairman, leaving, getting a big fine from regulators over LIBOR manipulation, lots of other bad news. And worst news for me personally that was that you were on holiday last week when this news broke. But you can make up for it now and tell us what you think of Anthony's appointment.
Well, I think the good news is that they've moved really swiftly to fill this. I mean, the appointment comes a bit sooner than anyone had expected. They thought it could sort of drag on. It could be harder to find someone suitable to fill the role. I mean, the new chairman who we have coming in, he starts this week, actually, Sir David Walker. He doesn't actually fully take over until November. So, you know, that's the positive, is that, we've got the new regime in place now. And Anthony Jenkins is considered a safe pair of hands, but it's very much that idea of safe, reliable, rather than inspirational, rather than, you know, something that got investors really excited last week.
Which is really what Bob Diamond was, wasn't it? He was, you know, a lot of people were enthralled to Bob Diamond. He was a very charismatic banker, an investment banker, of course. But how long did he last? Not very long.
Well, exactly. And I think they would not want a repeat of the kind of events that we saw under Bob Diamond. They want a definite break from the kind of culture he presided over, that very, you know, bonus focus, sort of quite aggressive stance that he took with regulators and the government. And I think Anthony Jenkins is regarded as a softer kind of personality, someone who's very methodical, very intelligent, just gets the job done, but may not have the kind of inspiration and creativity to really deliver some outstanding returns, you know, for shareholders. So I think we're probably looking at a bank, you know, really that sort of plods on a bit more than has the big rise in profits and the big growth that we saw in investment banking under Bob Diamond.
And then the scandals. What about Mr. Jenkins's track record? He's been back at the bank. I think he started there as a trainee many years ago, but he's been back with Barclays for the past 6 years, first as head of Barclaycard, the credit card operation, and then for the past three as head of the whole retail operation. He's done a pretty decent job there, hasn't he?
He has. I mean, definitely Barclaycard is one of the strongest performing divisions of Barclays. So he's definitely considered to have done a good job there. And I mean, the retail arm currently is having a pretty tough time, but like all retail banks are.
And that's partly him having to kind of undo some of the expansive strategy of his predecessor, Fritz Seegers, right?
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't been in charge of the whole division that long. I mean, I guess the sort of blemishes on his record would be PPI.
Which he's not directly involved with the retail bank, but it would have been part of what went on at Barclaycard.
It was, well, both, actually. It was Barclaycard and the UK bank were both involved. And also Barclays has been one of the worst offenders in the mis-selling of interest rate swaps to small businesses. It took a provision earlier this year that was way bigger than any other bank. So,
and to what extent would he personally have been involved with either of those things and to what extent was he inheriting?
He was at Barclaycard at the time when PPI still would have been sold. I mean, the worst time really was sort of 2006-07.
So just when he came in.
When he came in. But everyone was doing it, you know, and we've seen even banks like the Cooperative and Nationwide were also involved in PPI. And I think Barclays did respond quicker than some others, definitely quicker than Lloyds Banking Group, to rectify and stop selling it when, you know, the issues sort of first emerged and the problems emerged there. And I think the other thing to say about Anthony Jenkins is he's pretty popular internally. I think he has a good relationship with lots of staff and with the government and regulators.
And that'll be a priority to rebuild those relationships, clearly. And for the time being, at least on the back of last week's comments, investors are giving him a break. I think they're pretty pleased that they have an external chairman now, Sir David Walker. But on that basis, they were happy, at least the ones that I spoke to have an internal continuity candidate, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, the other question it raises is what it means for the investment banking side of Barclays, which, you know, is widely thought to need some kind of slimming down, repositioning now.
But can he do that in an orderly way by keeping the faith, if you like, with the staff, particularly in the US?
Exactly. I mean, he was one of the only candidates for the job, in fact, perhaps the only shortlisted candidate for the job that did not have, you know, direct investment banking experience.
Yeah. Exactly. We should move on to our second story of the day, which is the story moving on, if you like, that RBS is pressing ahead with its float of Direct Line. Alistair, you have been following the story for some time. No secret that they are wanting to float Direct Line, but we've got some figures out from the bank today. I suppose the obvious question is, why would you float a business now, particularly a motor insurer now? Is it a good time?
Well, I think the answer to that, really, the honest answer is perhaps because they really have to.
Right. Make it clear, this is ordered by the European Commission as part of the penalties for the state aid they took when they were nationalised.
Yeah, they have to seek control by the end of next year and get rid of the whole thing by the end of the following year.
Right.
Of course, they don't have to IPO it. There's clearly a pretty tough market out there for IPOs at the moment. This would be the biggest flotation by a UK company in the past 3 years.
Right.
So it is debatable whether you'd do this now unless you had to.
But they're pressing ahead with it despite potential for a trade sale.
Yeah, interestingly, yeah. I mean, we've had a few UK insurers caution now about the state of the motor market, and the industry's had quite a decent run with rising premiums, but that's recently gone into reverse. And just last week, Admiral was saying it reckoned the market would be tough for at least the next year or so. There's a host of regulatory changes coming up, including a ban on referral fees, which doesn't help.
So given that headwind, how much can they get for this business, do you think?
Well, it's worth remembering RBS was hoping to fetch £7 billion for it 4.5 years ago. It entertained interest from trade buyers, private equity, and rejected them all as too low.
Mm-hmm.
So Direct Line's now got a tangible net asset value of about £2.3 to £2.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
RSA is on about 1.7 times that, its tangible book value.
In terms of what it's trading in the market at,
yeah.
So that would attach a valuation of, $3 billion or 4 billion maybe?
No one in the city thinks Direct Line would get 1.7 times.
Right.
An analyst I was talking to this morning reckoned they could maybe get 1.2 times, talking there about a £2.93 billion market cap.
Right.
So he reckoned if they go for 3.5, it's just going to get not the best reception.
And what's the timing, as far as you understand, going forward now? Will it happen in the autumn?
Remember, they're doing this in tranches, the first chunk of about 20%. They've said in various different statements, if I had talked about the second half of this year or October.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they're doing the whole thing at once,
no.
Which counts in their favour.
Mm-hmm. And what figures did you... You said there were some figures out earlier today. What
analysts reckon they've done a sort of decent enough job of making operational improvements. The combined ratio, which is like the measure of underwriting profitability in the insurance sector, is still above 100, which means they're losing money. But you can still make a decent return, investment income, other sources, fees.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of moving in the right direction. Paul Geddes, the chief exec, was saying today they're targeting £100 million worth of cost savings and a 15% return on tangible equity. So,
given the difficult environment, it looks doable.
Yeah, it's seen as a sort of quite well-run UK motor insurance. It's also worth bearing in mind, it's not just motor. They've got home insurance, a rescue business called Green Flag, commercial insurance for SMEs. They've got assets in Italy and Germany.
Okay. And Charlene, how important is this for RBS?
Well, it's the last of the big disposals that they had to do as a result of the state aid that they had 3 years ago. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, they're getting on with this quicker than the sale of their retail branches, which started nearly 2 years ago.
Yeah.
They agreed to sell that to Santander, and that disposal still hasn't completed. So, I mean, it's another step in that process. They have made taking fairly quick action to meet those state aid remedies. They've got, as Alistair said, till the end of 2013 to do that. I mean, they don't want to sell this business, as we've heard, but given that they had to, I think, you know, it's good that they're getting on and doing it and taking the steps they have to.
CEO Stephen Hester's probably not going to be shedding too many tears over getting half the value that he might have got 4 or 5 years ago, given that the thing has to be done. And as you say, it's the last big disposal that they need to do. Brooke has been waiting patiently to talk about our final topic for the day. This is tweaks to the Basel rules, this time concerning liquidity. It seems, Brooke, that there is a mood towards maybe softening the rules around liquidity buffers.
Exactly. Basically, what's happened is the liquidity rules are the first ever attempt to deal with the run that brought down Lehman Brothers. And the global regulators really want to have rules in place to prevent that from happening again, but they don't actually know how they'll work in practice.
Now, this is a problem because they never existed in the past, right? Kind of pre-crisis, there wasn't such a thing as regulated liquidity provisions.
Exactly. You would have a conversation with your supervisor about whether they thought you had enough assets, but there weren't any global minimums, there weren't any standards, because everyone figured banks could do that.
Yeah.
And of course, it turned out not to be true. And what's happened is they had put out what they said were going to be the rules in 2010, and the industry went nuts and said, you know, we're short trillions and trillions of dollars, and there just aren't enough good assets that will fit in this buffer. Because the way they've defined the buffer is you have to have cash, you have to have gilts, you have to have other sovereigns, and you have to have really high-rated corporate bonds.
Yep.
And there just, frankly, aren't enough.
Yep.
And so what has happened is over time, the regulators have thought about how can we soften this so that it still preserves its meaning, that these banks do have to have pools, but that we also don't freak the markets out and lead to hoarding of assets.
Mm-hmm.
After lots and lots of proposals and lots of lobbying by the industry, the ones that look like they're going to go through, and it's not done, mm-hmm. there's still three meetings basically between now and January when it all gets finalized, are that they will be allowed to count equities from very large stocks that are non-financial, and they'll have to count twice as much. So basically, for every one you need for the liquidity buffer, you'd need two equity.
Right, which is known in the jargon as take a 50% haircut, basically, on the value of the equities.
Exactly.
Now, equities weren't going to be allowed at all.
Absolutely not, because the problem with equities is they are very liquid, and you can always sell them, but they're not price stable.
But so you deal with that with the haircut. Yeah.
The other big thing that they're likely to change, and again, the votes aren't all lined up, is that the way they calculate how much each bank has to have depends on what the bank has. And one of the big rules is you have to keep enough cash and liquid assets on hand to deal with a 5% outflow of your retail deposits, like a mini bank run.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a move to cut that to 3%. Which, although it sounds really small, makes a huge difference for the very biggest universal banks, which are where most of the shortfall is. And the third thing that really matters is you also are supposed to be holding assets in case all of your corporate customers all at once draw down on their lines of credit, because mm-hmm. most banks offer lines of credit that corporates don't use except for, you know, to deal with a rollover of commercial paper. And right now you have to have 100%, enough so that if everybody drew down at once, you could still fund it. That didn't happen in the crisis. The banks say that's crazy and will make lines of credit unnaturally expensive and be problematic for the commercial paper market, because every commercial paper comes with a backstop that's a line of credit that you don't basically pay for right now. And there is a move led primarily by the United States, but with real support, to reduce that somewhat. Probably, you know, it's unclear how much less than 100%, but it will be lower than 100%.
Going back to the assets that will be allowed, you talked about the equities haircuts and them being allowed into the pool. There had been a lot of talk about certain other assets, gold, I remember.
Gold's not getting anywhere. The
right.
gold bugs are trying. There may be a couple of regulators who are interested in doing it. There are 27 members on the Basel Committee, and I don't see gold getting even a majority.
What about corporate bonds? Is the threshold being dropped there from the top kind of ranking?
Right now it's double A or above. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a move to take it to single A. Some, particularly in Europe would like to take it down to triple B. That's more debatable. The other thing that's out there is the ECB, the European Central Bank, is pushing a completely different definition, which would say basically anything you can take to your central bank as collateral should count.
Right.
That, in the eyes of many other regulators, undoes the whole thing because it becomes a government aid system rather than a privately sellable assets. The ECB is pushing it very hard, though. Again, I don't think it's going to pass. There seems to be a lot of opposition, and including some members of countries that use the ECB. Germany is considered to be opposed to this. By all accounts, the US doesn't like it. The UK is pretty squishy on it as well.
Could there be a different regime for Europe in the same way as we know that the legislation CRD4 that's implementing Basel on the Basel rules generally is kind of taking a different stance on certain aspects? Could that be the case on liquidity or not?
It's possible. As written, CRD4 says we're leaving a hole for liquidity. We're waiting to see what Basel does. The text that's coming through is completely blank, basically, on liquidity. That certainly could be a way to do it. The thing is, given that some of the big opponents of the ECB's idea are within Europe, it's not clear to me how all that will play out.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a running story that we'll have to keep tabs on over the next few months. Thanks very much. That's all for this week, sadly. All that's left for me to do is to thank Charlene, Brooke and Alistair for their contributions and to thank you for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Katie Carney. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.